ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Every time we make life easier, we give something away. A click here, a quick login there. Convenience has a price. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I explore what we trade for comfort online and how to take some of it back. Opt Out, a special series on Download This Show. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Can we have the third prize go to 335?
I'm Joyce Sullivan, and along with husband John, we breed Papillons. She's very nosy. Her nickname is Nosy Parker.
Welcome to What the Duck, where we've sent producer Nat Tenchich to the Kilmore Kennel Club show in Victoria.
Everyone competes for the breed. Then after that, each breed goes against each other for the best in the group. And then later on, you represent that toy group in Best in Show.
How do you like your chances?
Well, you're in there. Win, lose or draw. It's a lot of fun with your dog.
These events are a little bit like a toddler beauty pageant, but for dogs. It's your chance to show off the best Dalmatian or Borzoi that you can make. Actually, is make the right word?
You breed, for the betterment of the breed, you want good purebred Papillons. We would like perfect Papillons. So the thing is, you're trying to breed perfection.
Immaculate perfection. Ordained, as if from God, who, on day six, according to the Bible, apparently formed wild and tame land animals, including pit doodles and papillons.
There's no such thing as an ancient breed.
Oh, so the Bible wasn't really talking about chow chows?
Generally, the older the dog that you're looking at, the more you go, it just looks like your standard mutt.
Rude, but okay, ancient dogs didn't look like pugs or shelties. Gregor Larson is talking about really old dogs, like tens of thousands of years old. That's like a billion in dog years.
All those extreme traits have really only appeared in the last 150 years.
Wait, dogs, as we know them, our oldest friends, apparently, are sort of not so old? On ABC Radio National, Dr. Anne Jones here, and this is What the Duck, your podcast voted most likely to get the side eye at posh dinner parties. And we've got a whole entire season going on all about the science of dogs. And we started last episode right back at the very beginning of the story.
Every dog ever is descended from a Eurasian population of grey wolves.
But if that's the case, then why don't they all look wolfy? This is Dogs, Chapter 2. What is a breed, anyway?
It does seem to be a universal trait that we are fascinated by these patterns of distinctiveness, and then we will try and proliferate those.
Gregor Larson, the bloke who just before said that for a long time all dogs just look like mutts, he's an Oxford paleogenomics professor who studies ancient dogs. And one of the first traits that we humans started to select for in dogs was coat colour.
So our desire for novelty is so great that we're not just content with the first one that distinguishes it from the camouflage or from the wild coat colouring, that we then go, oh, it's not just white. Oh, look, you've got Dalmatians with black spots. Oh, yeah, more of those. Let's make the whole movies about those. The only reason these mutations are allowed to pop up and persist in the first place is because those populations are now wedded to people in a way that their wild ancestors were not.
So that's how dogs start looking different to wolves. They could get away with having non-camouflage colours and, frankly, absurd floppy ears and tiny little legs that meant that they can't jump onto a couch, much less bounce on prey. And it's all because we humans were offering a ride around the roadblocks of natural selection. But the specific breeds thing? Well, like advertising, child factory labour, bank holidays and telephones, you can blame this one on the Victorians.
Before the Victorian era, dogs were largely bred and kept for their function.
That's Professor Michael Warboys, science historian and author of The Invention of the Modern Dog. Up until the mid-19th century, dogs were all sorts of things. They were guards, herders, hunters, transporters, you name it, they did it.
We can talk about types and varieties of dogs. as though they were like the colours of a rainbow. There were distinct types, but they were on a continuum. But there was no uniform look of a retriever. Indeed, somebody wrote in 1857 that any dog can be a retriever. And if you go to the park and watch someone throw a ball, it's pretty clear that any dog could be a retriever.
But now we have golden retrievers,
Labrador retrievers,
flat-coated,
curly-coated,
Irish water spaniels,
Portuguese water dogs,
Chesapeake Bay retrievers. But if your Shih Tzu fetches a ball, it's a lap dog? What is with all of this weird categorising?
The Victorian era was the era when Britain had the largest empire. It was an industrial pioneer, so it was a very powerful country politically, but also culturally.
Victorian culture was defined by the Industrial Revolution. Machine manufacturing brought about uniformity, structure, productivity, and for some, more free time for really weird hobbies. And hot on the heels of a huge poultry fancying fad, the Victorians turned to dogs, delineating and proliferating what we would now call breeds.
And rather than being like the colours on a rainbow, they became like the colours on a paint sample card that you get at a DIY shop. So you get discrete colours with gaps between them. And it's that switch, really, from dogs as a spectrum to dogs as a paint card, which is the essence of the Victorian explosion in dog breeds. It's not just that you've got a proliferation of colours, but also is that those colours are uniform. And the difference between, say, a retriever in 1830, which was defined by its function, and a retriever in 1870, 1880, it was defined by what it looked like, by its form.
Literally, form over function. The Victorians loved a bit of standardisation, from the factory system to cricket wickets across the country. And that's what they did for the dogs too. They created breed standards.
Every dog has its own standard, like a blueprint for what they're supposed to be. So when you're judging, you're measuring each dog against that blueprint.
Unrelenting beauty standards, doggy style. We're at the Kilmore Dog Show with the duck producer, Nat, who, like a collie, has rounded up...
I'm Wayne Douglas, OAM. I've been showing dogs since the late 70s.
Wayne.
You are showing Afghans at the moment. What made you choose Afghans?
Oh, as a kid, I used to watch all those Arabian movies, and there was always an Afghan sitting next to some emir or some sultan or something, and sort of became curious and not infatuated, but really, really intent on one. And then as kids, friends gave us one as a pet.
This is more than a love for the animal, though. This is a job and a project.
And the ultimate aim of breeding dogs is to try and improve a breed.
What is the best of the breed then? How do you breed the most Afghani Afghan?
They're supposed to be dignified and aloof. They're supposed to have this oriental expression.
Oriental expression. If you needed further clues that the dog breeding standards originated in the Victorian era, look no further than the language.
They have hip bones that are prominent. They have a ring at the end of their tail, which is really unique to them. Not very many dogs will have that little ring at the end of the tail. So they're all the sorts of things you want to try and preserve when you're breeding.
So the breed standard is sort of a list of traits.
Large, round, not apple-headed, with no indentation of skull.
That's from the Pug breed standard, by the way. And of course, the ultimate judge of which dog has adhered most closely to these beauty standards is the judge at the dog show.
My name is Esther Joseph. I'm an all-breeds judge. I've judged most places around the world.
So here's the process, according to Esther.
You see the seven dogs come in the ring, you look at them and you say, I really like that dog. At that stage, you haven't put your hands on the dog, looked at its head, is it a correct breed type, gone down, felt at the shape of its body, its bone, all the other things that is required to look for in the standard, and then you move them, preferred the movement on that other dog better than the movement on this dog. So then in the end, they're all lined up and you're going to say to yourself, there's my winner out there.
It's beauty pageants, but for dogs.
Which represents, by the way, a complete outlier in our relationship with dogs.
Gregor Larson is talking about humans across the tens of thousands of years that we've been friends with wolf dogs.
There is no correlate going back 15,000 years that bears any resemblance to the way that Victorians and dogs started interacting, which is a radical departure from everything prior to that. Dogs had to conform to a pedigree, that you would only accept them if they had this whole line of written down lineage of all these dogs with ridiculous eight names and everything.
Okay, so it's one thing to want a pretty dog, and I understand that the Victorians like to categorize things too, but how did they end up having essentially these beauty pageants for dogs?
From the early 19th century, the animal welfare movement in Britain banned bear baiting and cockfighting.
Michael Warboys, author and historian.
And one alternative to this was a sport called ratting.
Sport is an interesting word, but essentially, imagine a Victorian pub, lots of men, and a square arena.
And you would have a terrier dog, and then you would put in 50 rats, and you would time to see how long it took the terrier to kill 50 rats.
This activity required a constant supply of rats, which, even in Victorian London, was hard to keep up with.
On nights when they didn't have enough rats, they would have what they call beauty shows, where the men would bring in their dogs, and they would sit round a pub.
And instead of rat slaughter, that judge, whose dog was the prettiest pretty princess.
And they would sit there with their little terriers on their laps, and they would go around and decide which was the most beautiful.
It all snowballs from there. The beauty competitions become more socially acceptable, and these men sell terrier pups to upper-class ladies as lap dogs.
So dogs became a status symbol, that it wasn't just your pet, it was a high-class, valuable pet.
While the popularity of other fads like orchid delirium or fancy pigeon fancying waned, the dog obsession just went from strength to strength.
And the Victorians did us a real solid in expanding the absolute understanding of what a dog could look like, how it could morph into essentially anything that we want it to morph into aesthetically. Now we've really taken that and just run with it.
That's Angela Perry, zoo archaeologist, and this is Michael Warboys.
The International Federation recognised over 400 breeds. So there's a breed for every occasion. There's a breed for every taste. There's a breed for every size of home. There's a breed for every job.
We've created every version of a doodle. We've created every version of like hair color and fur type. And if we dream it, we can make it.
What I'm hearing is don't let your Irish doodle dreams stay in the fantasy realm. But seriously, it's actually hard to think of any other species that has so much variation in its looks.
And a lot of us would argue dogs have more variation than any land mammal on the planet.
Dr. Elaine Ostrander is Distinguished Senior Investigator with the National Human Research Institute of the National Institutes of Health in the USA. But don't be fooled by all those human words and titles. She studies the dog genome.
Their coats can be long or short or straight or curly. Their tails can be little nubs or long wraparound sorts of things. Their legs can be long. Their legs can be stubby. I mean, I could just go on and on. All of dog breeds are members of the same species, Canis lupus familiaris. And they differ in size by 40-fold.
They differ in size by 40-fold. You might as well be looking at a capybara versus a yak. But how? You expect there to be variation in every species, right? Think of the different types and colours of human hair. But would you guess that a Great Dane and a Chihuahua were the same species? It's a 40-fold difference in size. That would be like a giraffe ranging from 5 metres down to 40 centimetres. Or a magpie from its normal size through to a 1.7 metre terrifying swooper. It's ludicrous. So how does that amount of variation happen within one species?
That's the most important question in my lab, in dog genetics. How does that happen? What's going on in the genome of dogs that permits all that variation in a single species? What I think makes dogs unique is that it really comes down to their genome sequence, those A's and T's and C's and G's that we've been hearing about since we were in grade school. And what we find in dogs, it's different than other systems, is that there's really a small number of changes of very large impact that account for a lot of those differences.
How how much genetic difference actually is there between given breeds?
I couldn't give you an actual number, but they're very similar. I'm Heidi Parker. I'm an associate investigator at the National Human Genome Institute, National Institutes of Health in the United States.
Heidi and Elaine work together in a lab that collects doggy DNA from all over the dog breed spectrum to try and figure out some of the genetic puzzles.
So the differences are really minor changes in a few genes that will change appearance.
In humans, the difference between being 5 foot six and 6 foot six, there have been hundreds of places in the genome that are thought to contribute. But in dogs, the difference between being a 5-pound dog versus a 50-pound dog breed is actually a much, much, much tinier number of positions in the genome.
This is really curious. Compared to most other mammals, there's only a handful of positions on the dog's genome that determine these big differences in physical traits.
We've identified about 30 body size genes for that Great Dane versus Chihuahua and that Mastiff versus Pekingese, right? And it makes sense because most of these breeds have only been around for a couple hundred or so years.
But I am just so confused because the genetic differences are minor, but the physical differences are immense.
They are extremely different. One of the things that we like to do with like school kids is look at skulls. Here's a skull of, say, a Great Dane. It will have a skull of a pug and say, you know, what do you think these are? And they're like, oh, a bear and a monkey, you know? They don't look like they're the same thing at all. But what we have found so far looking at the genetics of the dog is that these are not big differences. They're just little differences here and there that just add up to really big changes.
And so what we have tried to figure out is all of this variation just embedded like in the wolf genome? Do they have variants to make dogs big and small and polka dotted like a Dalmatian and, you know, screw tails and ears up, ears down? Is all of that embedded in the wolf genome? And we're just beginning to answer that. And we found recently that genes that can make canids bigger, small, are embedded in the wolf genome.
The genes were there, and maybe they expressed themselves occasionally, but a sausage-shaped wolf didn't survive. That is, not without humans who were fans of sausage-shaped animals.
They've been around for over 50,000 years. So why does a 50,000-year-old wolf need a variant in its DNA sequence to make it small? Not a good plan if you're a wolf. You want to be big 50,000 years ago, right? But it's like nature kept some of these things, and I don't think all of them, but she's kept some of these things in her back pocket so that when they were needed, they were there. They were ready to go.
And without those sleeping DNA variations in grey wolves from Ice Age Refugia, that Chihuahua that you saw at the coffee place yesterday, it wouldn't be able to fit into that hand-quilted doggy carrier. Though do spare a thought for mutations, they do play a role in how dogs might look too.
Non-lethal, aesthetic mutations that just pop up that breeders, who are great geneticists, let me just say, they're fantastic geneticists, jump on and they know how to set up the breeding programs to very quickly get something into the mainstream of the breed.
But what does all this trait selection, breed perfecting, and potential genetic cul-de-sacking do to the actual quality of a dog's life? Michael Warbois says that the Victorian, that's the era, not the state, the Victorian pedigree obsession very quickly led to health problems.
By the end of the Victorian period, you begin to see health problems, certain breeds difficult to breed because they lose fertility, others become deaf. And so you get a whole series of problems coming from these kind of closed populations of uniform-looking dogs that breed together.
There is no doubt that in some areas, breeding is creating increasingly severe traits, and some of these do have negative impacts on dog well-being. But does that mean that the dogs are inbred?
I think the generalization is not true and it is not right.
Just reminding you, Elaine Ostrander is a geneticist.
there are clearly, from our DNA studies, breeds that have a lot more genetic variation than other breeds. There's no doubt about that. There are breeds that have had an excess of popular sires or bottlenecks that have reduced genetic variation in that breed. Absolutely true.
This is sometimes called popular sire syndrome. And in a way, it's another product of those Victorians, the shows, the breed standards, the desire for this or that snout length or leg shape or coat type, right? It means that on occasion, one sire, a male dog, can be responsible for a significant amount of puppies born in a generation of a breed. For example, in 1914, there was a 3-year-old Scottish Terrier called Bapton Norman, which sounds like an investment firm, but he had sired several champions already, and he was so popular that bitches, that is, female Scottish Terriers, were being sent around the world to be bred with him. Other extremely popular sires from the time included French Bulldog Nellcote Gammon and the Irish Terrier Thorncroft Sportsman. Yes, they do all sound like they went to Eton. And yes, breeding within your own class only can create a bit of a bottleneck or a blood disorder. The breed standards do sometimes call for purebreeds to only have purebred parents, and thus the introduction of new genetic material is only from mutation, not breeding outside that population.
But that doesn't mean they're any less healthy. It isn't so much what you throw out of the pot, it's what you leave in the pot that matters.
Which trait is bred and which trait is excluded is increasingly under the spotlight. For example, the Norwegian Kennel Club has a program to prevent hip dysplasia in certain breeds.
What goes in is what comes out. And so let's say you're going to make a mixed breed dog, or you want to make some new breed, and you combine three breeds, and all three of those breeds have terrible hip dysplasia. All right? Guess what? Your new outbred population is going to have a lot of hip dysplasia, even though you went and you crossed these three breeds.
What Elaine is saying is that the problem isn't outcrossing or inbreeding like you might think. The problem is breeding from undesirable dogs. The breeders that Nat spoke to at the dog show go to great lengths to stop genetic problems, like pug breeder and judge Esther Joseph.
We're having a lot of problems with pugs because they're a brachycephalic breed and they have a flat face. They have breathing issues. So we do testing, RFG testing, which is test for a disease called Boas.
This is a test and a disease that's all about respiratory function. It's linked to the fact that their face and upper airways can be all squashed up.
So they get a score, and this dog here has a score of 0. So if I've got a bitch at home that is, let's say, a 1 or even a 2, you would never put it to a 1 or a 2 score. You'd try and go to a dog with 0. So that's, you're just trying to improve the breed and keep the breed healthy. It's very important. Otherwise, we'll lose the breed.
Again, it really depends what's in the pot and what's out of the pot, right? And what really matters is what's in it, not so much what you throw out of it.
Breeding, though, isn't an exact science. There is still chance involved, and there might be some things in the pot that you didn't quite realise were there, bubbling away, generation after generation. The selection of one trait can sometimes influence other things that we might not have expected, like breeding for tameness, resulting in floppy ears, or smaller breeds showing more aggressive traits, like the furious might of the yappy chihuahua. That is actual audio recorded by Nat at the dog show. Scary stuff. From the Victorian era on, we might have been breeding to make the perfect Chinese crested dog or whatever, but as we've done that, we've inadvertently bred and exacerbated other traits. Here's Heidi Parker talking about how, post-World War II, the Soviets used a state-run kennel called Red Star Kennels to try to breed up their own patriotic versions of dog breeds.
Many of them very successful, but they had a couple of failures. And one was that they wanted to make a water dog, a water retrieval dog, like a Newfoundland, but a Russian version. So they crossed Newfoundlands, maybe something else, but with the Caucasian Ovcharka, which is a flock guardian that chases wolves for a living.
An absolutely immense dog.
And they said the problem was the dogs were great swimmers. They would dive into the water, go for the drowning person, but they tended to bite them instead of bringing them back.
Well, so the story goes anyway.
So they were more like, guard the ship in the water from these terrible drowning people over there, rather than save the drowning people.
Needless to say, the Moscow water retriever no longer exists. So it's not necessarily survival of the fittest for domestic dogs, it's the survival of the friendliest. And that is what we'll be talking about next time here on What the Dog. What the Duck. This episode of What the Duck was produced by me, Anne Jones, Nat Tenchich, and Rebecca McLaren on Wurundjeri, Tungwurrung, and Wadawurrung country.
Oh, you are perfect. Oh my goodness, you're going to eat my cable.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.